as webradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Yeah. This is Michael Gineau with Insight to Israel, brought to you by America's Web Radio. And I want to thank all of the guys at America's Web Radio for bringing the truth of the Jewish state to the grassroots of the United States of America, the patriot conservatives, and the Christians that stand with Israel in her fight for sovereignty and security. And America's Web Radio brings the greatness of the Jewish state as she leads the way in technology, agriculture, medicine, and the vast amounts of humanitarian work that Israel does all around the world. It's amazing. Thank you to the guys at America's Web Radio. Also want to give a great big thank you to everyone who has given to Hershey's for Heroes. Last year, Americans sent over 1,000 chocolate bars to the Israeli soldiers with a note on each one thanking them for defending the Jewish state. And I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you to everyone who took the time, purchased the bars, put the notes on, and sent them to the Jewish state. You will never know the morale boost that it gives to a soldier just to see that note on there. Thank you for all that you've done. And we are poised. Our goal this year is to do 1,000 bars a month. Recently, I'm here with a good friend of mine, former Ambassador Yoam Edinger. I know, Yoam, you told me to call you Yoam, but I respect you, sir. That being said, Yoam, this month we had a church in South Carolina go and purchase 500 chocolate bars.
Wow.
500. Yeah. Now, listen, when I was in the States, I went to the mail, I got bills. I come to Israel, you know what I get in the mail? Chocolate. So, thank you to everyone. Keep the chocolate bars coming. If you want to know how to contribute to Hershey's for Heroes, please go to Facebook. It's this simple, Hershey's for Heroes. Don't forget to like the page. Send me an email. You can do it even if you don't, I think if you don't have a Facebook page. But if you don't have a Facebook page, email me at mgano, G-A-N-O-E, at Insight to Israel, insighttoisrael.com. Thank you to everyone. Okay, wow, this has been a crazy week for Insight to Israel. I just got over the flu. I'm not going to give it to you. Can I call you former ambassador? Ambassador?
Just Yoram.
Yoram? Okay. Absolutely. All right. It's a beautiful day in the Jewish state, sir. It is another beautiful day. Craziness happened in the United States. We just had the State of the Union address. And this guy's, he's proven himself not to be a friend of Israel, that's for sure.
Well, but the interesting thing is that he had only one sentence addressing Israel and the conflict with the Arabs. However, when he said in that sentence that he aims at establishing a Palestinian state, there was absolutely no reaction from the 535 legislators. When he concluded the sentence by saying that America will always stand by the Jewish state, that's where he received thundering applause,
right,
which for me was a very, very strong signal that there is a gap between the president who approaches Israel and its neighbors by applying the immoral moral equivalence on one hand, and Congress and the American people, which understand that one cannot apply moral equivalence to the role model of counterterrorism Israel and the role model of terrorism, which is the Palestinian Authority.
Right.
You cannot apply moral equivalence to the role model of unconditional alliance with the U.S., which is Israel, and the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian leadership, which have been the allies of America's enemies and adversaries, starting with the Palestinian alliance with the Nazis
right.
during the Second World War with the communist bloc, with Ayatollah Khomeini, with Saddam Hussein, with Bin Laden, and the close ties they have today with Russia, with China, wow. and with rogue regimes such as North Korea, Cuba, Venezuela, and other adversaries, enemies of the USA.
Well, you know what, sir? That was a fantastic way to start out this interview. I want to say, forgive me if I slip up and say ambassador, former ambassador once in a while. I respect your position. Thank you for being here today, sir. It's a pleasure. We met through a very good friend of ours, and I started getting your emails from your newsletters. They're your email letters that you send out regularly that update on world events and how things affect the United States and Israel and our national security. And I have to say that it was very, very enlightening. You keep the verbiage in such a way, because not everybody understands political terms or terms of diplomacy. I'm certainly no diplomat. You're very straightforward. I'm a little more off the cuff and rogue in my speech sometimes, but that's sometimes what people want to hear. They want the truth. But you do it in a very down-to-earth, systematic, diplomatic way, and I certainly gleaned a lot from it. I want to start, though, by saying, again, it's a beautiful day in the Jewish state. Here in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel, I want to start by asking your age, and there's a reason why, because I want the listeners to become familiar with who you are and what led you up to today, because I'm sure that you've had a fascinating life and all these things that you've seen that have transformed your way of thinking. It's got to be amazing.
Well, I don't think it's amazing. There is a fact of life, and the fact of life is that personally, I have been blessed, I've been lucky to have been born at a time of the reconstruction of the Jewish Commonwealth in the land of Israel. Now, this is not to be taken for granted,
right.
because Jews were waiting for 2,000 years to rebuild the Jewish Commonwealth. What are the odds that someone would be born at the time when the Jewish Commonwealth is established?
When was that?
I was born in 1945,
wow.
3 years before the state was reestablished. Jewish state was reestablished.
Were you born here in Israel?
I was born in Israel. And therefore, being born at that time does behoove one to assume very, very great responsibility and sometimes also great sacrifice in order to justify this blessing of the rebirth of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. And that has led me to a 24/7 commitment to the cause of the Jewish people and the Jewish state.
Wow, wow. Let me ask you, 1945, there's a lot of things that Americans don't know about the history of Israel. And so starting with, were both your parents here in Israel? Were they born and raised here in Israel?
No, they were born in Poland.
Wow.
And
so
they came to Israel before the eruption of Second World War.
Wow. So both of them, so you're from Polish descent.
Right.
Did you have family members? I don't want to go too far back, but did you lose a lot of family members?
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, my parents, my grandparents, were severely criticized by many of their members of their families for being reckless and going to so-called forsaken part of the world to be murdered by Arabs, to be killed by Arabs.
Huh.
And most of the members of the family remained in Poland and unfortunately were massacred by
wow.
the Nazis.
Wow, that's amazing that they would ostracized, and yet at the same time they had no, they could have never fathomed, I'm sure, what they were headed for by staying behind.
Well, my grandfathers analyzed the situation very realistically, and they did foresee the rise of Hitler and its implications.
Wow.
And therefore they gradually relocated the immediate family to Israel.
How did they get here? Did they come by boat? Or?
Oh, yeah, by boat.
Wow.
Yeah.
So your parents came here. God bless them. I mean, that took some strength.
Oh, yeah.
To
yeah.
leave.
Those days, yeah. Those days, they left comfort of relatively wealthy homes in Poland. And they came to an area which had barely any demographic, economic, or military infrastructure, surrounded by Arabs who did not hide their intentions to eradicate the Jewish community in the area.
Let me clarify something for the listener. The word Arab is a cultural term here in the Middle East. Globally and here in Israel, we have a big problem that we're not willing to confront. And I'm saying this. I'm not going to speak for you. I say it blatantly. We have an Islamic problem. And I say this for as a representative, as someone who started Insight to Israel. The word radical and extremist are terms that we've been duped into using when the Quran actually calls for this type of violence that is being spewed upon the world. With that being said, that is amazing that they would leave, and the American Jews could certainly look to your parents as an example of what to do in this day and age. I respect them, sir. Are they? They're obviously probably not still around.
No, they're not.
So what was life? Where did you grow up here in Israel?
Well, I grew up, I was born in Tel Aviv, and then relocated to Jerusalem, where I live, reside until today. And following my military service, I came to El Paso, Texas, to do my undergraduate.
Yeah.
And from there, I moved on to UCLA in California to do my graduate studies. I was certified as a CPA in California while I went to school, and after conclusion of my studies, I was offered to work for 3 years as an information officer at the Israeli Consulate General in Los Angeles.
Nice.
Came back to Israel. And in fact, I worked for 2 years in the American public diplomacy arm in Jerusalem, and then was offered to establish and run a Middle East research unit in the Israeli bureaucracy.
Wow.
Which I did for 10 years. And then was appointed as Consul General of Israel to the southwestern states based in Houston, Texas, dealing with Texas and Oklahoma and Louisiana, Arkansas and New Mexico. I was called back to Israel to head the government press office, which is in charge of relations with the overseas media stationed in Israel, and then was reposted in the U.S. as an ambassador in charge of our congressional relations at the Israeli embassy in Washington.
Wow.
And
I don't mean to interrupt you, sir. I'm gonna backtrack here because I think it's important for the listeners to know. Your resume is fantastic, but first of all, you growing up here obviously affected what you did in the future. What was life before you joined the military and up until that point? What was life like for you here in Israel, for your family, when you were born in Tel Aviv and moved to Jerusalem? There was a lot of conflict when you look at the history going on. How did that? What was it like for you as a young man?
Well, obviously, the Arab threat has always hovered above the Jewish state, and we grew up within such an environment, and therefore there has always been a great sense of communal responsibility among youngsters as well as adults in Israel. There's been a sense of commitment to contribute to the strength, the growth of the Jewish state, and always looking up to the day when we would be privileged to join the military force in Israel.
Wow.
In fact, I remember the competition among my friends, who is going to get into a more combat-like unit in the military, and those who were not able, physically or otherwise, were not able to join combat units, usually felt somewhat inferior to the rest of us who were privileged to join the combat units. But there's no doubt that such an atmosphere has shaped our adult life.
Absolutely. You know, I see that today among, and I respect it, I honor it, because when I talk to these young people in the military, and I say thank you for your service to the country, their response is, first of all, it's red-faced. They're very humble. And they're very thankful. And they say, we have to. We must. You only have one. And it amazes me how the rest of the world, and I've seen some people here, not a lot, very few, but especially down in Tel Aviv, when I use the term Jewish state, no, we're very diverse. This is the state of Israel. We don't refer to it as a Jewish state. Well, the Italians have no problems referring to their country as an Italian country or a French. You know, I'm proud, even as a non-Jew, to say, you know what? I am here in the Jewish state, because it's the Jewish
Absolutely.
People that have born
Absolutely.
And bled on this soil for freedom.
Absolutely. And that sense, again, of commitment has also catapulted, I think, overall Israeli performance to new heights. I met recently a retired American combat pilot, and he told me about his experience in joint exercises with Israeli pilots, and according to him, he said that everything which the American pilots can do, the Israeli pilots do even better. I asked him, why would it be that way? After all, the IQ of the pilots is more or less the same.
Right.
The training is more or less the same. Why would Israeli pilots perform better than Americans? His response was that Israeli pilots consider every takeoff as a do-or-die takeoff
wow.
for the country.
Wow, wow,
a
wow.
feeling which is not shared by Americans because of the size of America, because of the power of America, because of the surroundings, the neighborhood of America, unlike our size, our surrounding, and our conflict-ridden and threatening, intolerant neighborhood.
Wow, that's very well put, sir. That's fantastic. So all these things. Now, where did you serve in the Army? What?
I was an officer in the artillery.
Very nice. Very nice. And an officer. That
right.
that says a lot. And I respect that, and thank you. Now, did you have to... Were you in any of the conflicts?
No, I was not.
Okay.
I was not.
And now, did you happen to know, and I want Americans to really research, because I think a lot do that listen to the radio show, Yonatan Netanyahu. which is Benjamin's brother,
right,
who was the leader and the designer of the raid at Entebbe. Did you happen to know him in any way?
I know the family.
Very good people.
I know the family. In fact, I knew both parents who passed away recently, but I never met Yoni, the oldest.
He's one of my heroes.
Oldest brother. But there's no doubt that the operation against international terrorism in Entebbe, Uganda, which was commanded by the late Yoni Netanyahu, is one of the many examples of the unique contributions by the Jewish state,
right,
to the U.S. in particular and the free world in general. Because there is no doubt that that the operation in Entebbe against the hijackers of the plane inspired America's counter-terrorism effort. The tactic used in that operation served as an example for the American counter-terrorism folks. The same way that today America's war on terrorism in Afghanistan and until a few years in Iraq has also been impacted by the Israeli experience. All American elite units on the way to Afghanistan, as it was on the way to Iraq, do go through Israel. And in Israel, they're trained for 3-4 weeks by Israel's top experts.
Did not know that.
Oh, yeah. By Israel's top experts on counterterrorism, suicide bombing,
wow,
car bombs, and the deadly IEDs, the improvised explosive devices. In fact, America's urban warfare in Afghanistan right now, as it was in Iraq, is greatly assisted by the Israeli experience. On American basis, in the U.S., you have models built by Israeli experts taken after the neighborhoods in Gaza, which shelter terrorists.
Right.
Israelis build those models based on our own experience in fighting terrorism in the urban centers of Gaza and in southern Lebanon.
Wow.
Americans, specialists in urban warfare, do come to Israel and they train by our experts in urban warfare, because unfortunately, tragically, both of us, U.S. and Israel, fight terrorists who use human shields.
Right.
And the question is, how do you minimize in civilian losses, and how do you minimize on combat soldiers' losses? And this is where Israel shares its experience with America's.
Wow.
When it comes to combating terrorism, we in Israel developed very special capabilities by the unmanned aerial vehicles, very special optic capabilities in those unmanned aerial vehicles. We use them daily in our warfare against Arab terrorism inside Israel and around Israel, and we have shared those technologies with Americans.
In fact, you lead the way.
Well, in 2014, in fact, Israel is the number one exporter of unmanned aerial vehicles.
In drones.
In drones.
Yeah.
But much of the newly developed technologies is done jointly by Israelis and Americans,
right,
whereby Israel leverages the great American capabilities of production, the great American innovative technologies, and Israel shares with America its own combat experience, its own breakthrough or groundbreaking technology, and together we have created, I believe, the best ever counterterrorism machine, which is American-Israeli developed and partly also jointly operated.
Wow, wow. You said a lot of great stuff there. I want to ask you one question because we've got a few minutes left in this segment. Did you think, what led you to the United States to go to school? I mean, what prompted you to do that?
My relatives from Texas.
Ah, okay. There we go. Now we're learning a little more.
Yeah, they invited
me. That's important to know.
They invited me primarily not to study, but they said, well, after your years in the military, why won't you take a break?
Right, and like most young people do.
And get some relaxation here in El Paso, Texas. And I also registered to school, but the main idea was to get away from the pressure in Israel, and that has led to actual studies and degrees, and later on joining the Israeli effort of public diplomacy.
And you never even had, you never even before that, you'd never given thought to it, I would imagine.
No.
So, see, this is what forms and shapes Yoram Edinger, and what brings, what knowing that from my standpoint, as someone who's not Jewish and respects the people and loves the people in this country, when I look at your life, that things happen that you could have never or never planned or thought.
Right, right.
It is amazing.
Well, somebody planned it for me.
Absolutely.
And I followed it. Without any, because I was supposed to be a CPA, I was supposed to be a businessman. And then suddenly a shift happened, and overnight I shifted the gears to a public diplomacy, and then heavily involved in U.S.-Israel relations, U.S. Congress, and my CPA career is summed up by a nice French certificate hanging in my office.
That's great. I think like a lot of Americans, we go and we get degrees in so many things and never end up doing,
right.
You know, I have a degree in education and theological studies. And
But it's very useful in whatever we do.
Absolutely.
Our education is extremely useful, and this is one of the key elements which has catapulted Israel to very impressive heights,
right.
The focus on education.
Right.
And this is part of our upbringing in our homes. It's part of the overall worldview in Israel, education, and education.
Yeah. You know what, sir? I'm going to ask you real quick before we take a break. I could go, it would take us show after show, and we're going to start actually doing a show with you once a month, because I think it's very important, your insight, if I could use the phrase, or the word, insight, into Israel, and looking at Israel, from Israel, at the world view. It's very important, because too many times, especially as Americans, we look at the world through the scope of the United States, we look at the world through the scope of the United States. And really, because Israel is, whether we want to admit it or not, and many times pride keeps us from admitting that Israel is the center of the world and always will be. God planned it that way. And I don't want to get off on, we could go all day on that, but when you look at Israel, when you look at the world through the scope of Israel, there's a whole lot of things that you see differently. And you see how the world's shaping up in a realistic way. And I'm very thankful that you're going to be a contributor once a month, because you have a lot to give.
It's my pleasure.
So we're going to be right back, and we're going to talk about the Edinger Report. And what I want to know, I'm very interested in to know your drive that brought you to work. This is Michael Gano with Insight to Israel. Every day, the Israeli Defense Force finds itself on the front line of the war with the militant arm of Islam. Surrounded by enemies from within and without, they fight for the only Jewish state. Military service is mandatory, ladies serving 2 years and men serving 3 right out of high school. While young people in other democracies are busy traveling or attending university, Israeli men and women gear up for basic training.
In a world of heads of state, politicians, ambassadors, diplomats, and a leftist media, many times our voice at the grassroots level is drowned out. So we started an ongoing project called Hershey's for Heroes. Patriot conservatives from all over the U.S. are sending Hershey's chocolate bars with a note of thanks for defending Israel. Won't you join us by sending a sweet message to the IDF? For information, please see my Facebook page at Michael Gonneau. Thank you, God bless Patriot conservatives, and God bless Israel in her struggle for sovereignty and security.
As a stick above the head of every single legislator on Capitol Hill, but also...
Do me a favor. Can you say that again? Because it's been so long since I've heard that, and Americans need to hear that from an Israeli, because our politicians do not feel as though they are held accountable, that their literal job is on the line if they do not, or if they are not obedient. And I use that term, obedient, to the constituents.
I must say that when you walk in the corridors of the House or the Senate, that notion of we shall remember in November reverberates all over, irrespective of the supposed apathy of the legislator to the will or wishes of the constituents. The reality is that they are very conscientious of the power of the constituents. They dread every second November, and they do follow very, very intensely the messages coming to their office, be it by phone, be it by mail, be it by faxes or personal visits. They take an account how many calls are in support and how many calls are in opposition. And it affects their daily conduct. And this is a very, very special, unique feature, which is typical only of the American political systems. Americans take it for granted,
right.
But you should not, because neither the European system nor the Israeli system accord constituents that much power.
Right.
It seems to me that if constituents would be aware of their power, they would have more impact on Capitol Hill.
Wow.
But anyway, spending 3 years in Washington, mostly on Capitol Hills, and since the end of my role at the embassy, sustaining that routine in my private capacity as a consultant to American and Israeli legislators, this has exposed me also to the unique attitude by American constituents and therefore legislators towards the Jewish state. In many respects, Israel has never been a classic foreign policy. The Jewish state, in many respects, has been a domestic issue, unlike any other country in the world, even more than Britain. Some assume that Britain and the U.S., Canada and the U.S., are the closest type of relationships the U.S. has in the world. I beg to differ, because if you go back to in American history, the establishment of the U.S. was in defiance of the British culture, in defiance of the Anglican Church, and it was in accordance with Judeo-Christian values. You go back to history, and every American learns that the loyalists who wanted the British to remain, they relied on the New Testament. The rebels who fought the British relied on the Old Testament. And for me to witness the unique friendship towards Israel, the unique respect towards the Jewish state was a new experience, and it was a game-changing experience as far as my own pride, being a Jew in the Jewish state and also being an ally of the U.S.
Wow. You know, it's very interesting. I just want to state this one historical fact for the record. It is amazing when you look when the pilgrims came to the United States, they befriended the Indians. In fact, they actually, many of them came to Christianity. Now, that's not always documented in history. But if you look at the same time, Jamestown, which was settled, Plymouth was settled for religious freedom purposes. Jamestown was settled for financial purposes, financial gain, and they treated the Indians down there terribly. And yet we see the result. We see the result that comes from those two camps where the pilgrims gave thanks to God. They honored God. They revered God. And had respect for the life of those who were there before them, where Jamestown did not, and we see the results of both of those camps. So I want to say thank you to you as not just an Israeli, but as someone who's Jewish. Thank you for receiving Torah from Hashem, because if you had not done that, then I would not have a Constitution or Bill of Rights. And that's a fact.
In fact, it guided the early pilgrims, because when you, again, study the sail of the few weeks between the coast of England or Holland all the way to the new continent, America, the USA, you also find out that there were sermons given on the boats, whether it was the Mayflower or the Arabella, and the sermons were centered around the crossing of the modern-day Red Sea, and the departure from modern-day Egypt, and the destination being the modern-day Promised Land.
Yeah.
Hence, the thousands of sites in the U.S. bearing biblical names. You have many more Jerusalems in the U.S. than we have in Israel. We have one Jerusalem, you have 18 Jerusalems,
wow.
And 32 Salems. Salem, Shalem is the original name of Jerusalem. We have one Bethlehem, and you have
Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Bethlehem.
Well, they're well into the high two digits number of Bethlehems, and so it is with,
wow,
Mount Zion, and so it is with Dothan and Boaz and Mitzpah and even Rehoboth in Delaware.
Never looked at it that way.
But that is a testimony to the role played by Judeo-Christian values in the initial journeys of the pilgrims to America.
Wow.
Then you look at the founding of the USA. Three of the founding fathers, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and Benjamin Franklin, they proposed a different official seal. It was not accepted, but they proposed a seal which was supposed to feature the crossing of the sea, the people of Israel following the pillar of fire, and the chariots of Pharaoh drowning in the Red Sea.
And it's very interesting you say that, because the left in the United States, and coupled with Islam, you would not believe what they're trying to say in the school books today, what they're actually saying. There's in Texas, there's a big controversy, you can Google it, where they're trying to say that Muslims discovered the United States. Now, that's so far-fetched and so insane. That's what Islam and the left, how insane they are trying to say about the United States.
Well, in fact, Islam has been part of the so-called American story since the early days of America, but in a different way.
Right.
The
Barbary pirates.
The Barbary pirates, the Muslim pirates from North Africa, who used to attack American boats, and as a result, they were targeted by a number of wars launched by Americans against their bases in order to free Americans of the Muslim threat.
Wow.
And since those early days until this very day, Islamic terrorism has targeted the U.S. as the big Satan.
And even,
Israel has been targeted as the small Satan. And by the way, I feel very honored to be a small Satan next to the big American Satan, because being referred to as Satan by the leaders of international terrorism, Muslim terrorists, is a badge of honor.
Yeah. You know what? Listen, this is great. Didn't plan on it, but that's okay, because we're getting a lesson here. I respect and appreciate the fact that you know American history, and some people would be so shallow as to attribute it to the fact that you're that you have the education that you do. But I'm not very, I'm educated, but I still know American history very well, and I appreciate the fact, as someone who's not American, you know more American history better than most Americans do today. And that, I think that says a lot about who you are as a person. What years were you actually working in Washington, D.C.? Tell me it's under the Reagan era, because that was a great time.
No, 89, 92. In fact, those were the days of the highest tension between the American and Israeli administrations, Bush Sr. and Jim Baker.
Yeah.
Were certainly no friends of the Jewish state, and
1,000 points of light and global governance,
right,
was
right.
What Bush Sr.
Right,
proposed,
right.
And a lot of people. Let me—I don't mean to interrupt you, but a lot of people in the United States are very deceived because they don't know their history, and they don't take a deeper look besides what the front page says.
Right, right. But those days were testimony. To the very intimate and productive relations between the two countries, because here you have two administrations that cannot get along and do not agree on anything which has to do with the Arab-Israeli conflict, with the Palestinian issue. However, at the same time, and primarily because of the congressional muscle,
right,
and the congressional worldview,
right,
the strategic cooperation between the U.S. and Israel surged to unprecedented heights. Time after time, the President Bush Sr. and Secretary Jim Baker tried to undermine the new initiatives by Congress, but time after time, Congress prevailed.
Wow.
And Congress prevailed because those initiatives were not for the sake of Israel. They were for the sake of America's national security, which has been greatly assisted by the Jewish state.
Absolutely.
We're talking about Israel being a beachhead for American interest in the Middle East, in a very critical area for America's national security and economic interest. And the late General Alexander Haig, who was the supreme commander of NATO forces and Secretary of State of the U.S., he always referred to Israel as the largest American aircraft carrier, which never required a single American aircraft or American boot on board, which could never be sunk, and was deployed, stationed in a most critical area for vital American interests. General Haig said that if there wouldn't be Israel in the eastern flank of the Mediterranean, then the U.S. would have to deploy a few more real aircraft carriers, which would have cost the American taxpayers some $15 billion annually.
Wow.
All of which has been spared by one Jewish state.
Wow.
In the eastern flank of the Mediterranean. And by the way, we have proven that many times. Just to give an example, back in 1981, Israel preempted the Iraqi nuclear effort, destroying the Iraqi nuclear reactor. It was done, by the way, in defiance of the American administration in 1981.
And that was during the Carter administration.
Reagan administration. And in fact, they punished Israel by a military embargo. However, 10 years later, 1991, following the first Gulf War, then Defense Secretary Dick Cheney said in a defense establishment meeting in Washington, "Thank you, Israel, for bombing the Iraqi nuclear reactor in 1981,
right,
which spared us, the U.S., a nuclear confrontation in 1991.
Wow.
Now, how many billions of dollars is that worth to the American taxpayers?
Absolutely.
But more importantly, how many lives have been spared by one such gutsy Israeli action in Iraq? Certainly, the Saudis and the Kuwaitis and Abu Dhabi and other pro-American Arab allies in the Persian Gulf were relieved by that Israeli operation against the Iraqi nuclear reactor, because they knew very well a nuclear Iraq would doom their own regimes."
You know, I want to ask you, it's very interesting you were in there during that time, because I was actually in Bible college at the time. And, you know, I kind of understand, and maybe you can fill us in, reflecting back, because you were obviously there during the first Gulf War, correct?
Right.
Okay. So, the guys and I in our dorm used to have our eyes. We weren't even allowed to have a TV in our dorms, in our dorm building. Okay, so the dean allowed us to have a black and white TV, and we were glued to it because, you know, when you're a bunch of guys sitting around in seminary talking about theological stuff and, you know, pro-Israel, because that's what our school emphasized, about this is a Jewish state, you fight with them no matter what, you know, this is their land. You know, we're praying and hoping one of those Scud missiles hits the Dome of the Rock so you can rebuild the temple. Now, you have to, we're young. There was a lot of things that we hoped for and loved Israel. But, you know, we were under the impression that looking at the Islamic world during that time, that, and I'm just giving you my perspective as a young man that's led up to today. Did Bush do the right thing by putting the Patriot missile batteries there, here in Israel, and shooting down the Scud missiles? Because he, am I right in my assumption that he knew if you attacked Iraq, even though you had done that before, if you attacked Iraq, that would inflame the whole Islamic world and therefore might interfere in the United States' ability to actually form a coalition and go after Saddam Hussein?
Well,
help me out with that.
In fact, the performance by the American administration in 1991 left a lot to be desired.
Okay.
The first thing was the initial reaction to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait in August of 1990. At that time, President Bush Sr.'s reaction was that he was considering all options but military. Fortunately, Margaret Thatcher,
great lady,
in Washington at that time, she and President Bush flew together to Aspen, Colorado, and in Aspen, Bush held another press conference, and at the advice of Margaret Thatcher, he said, military option is on the table. And when the war broke out, President Bush committed himself to destroy the missile launchers which were aimed at Israel. The sad fact is that not a single missile was destroyed by American Air Force. And the reason was that the American planes flew at a very high altitude in order to minimize the chance of being hit by ground-to-air
surface-to-air
missiles. As a result, Israel received many more missiles than was expected. As far as I know, the Patriot missiles did not hit any incoming Iraqi missiles, and if they did, it was very small number of them. More than that, during the few months prior to Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in 1990, I walked around the corridors in Washington, alerting Americans that Saddam was on a war path. This was in contrast with the briefings conducted by the administration, which referred to Saddam Hussein as an ally of America. The very gullible reference was, the enemy of my enemy, namely the enemy of Iran, is my friend.
Right.
I always contended that the enemy of my enemy in the Middle East could also be my enemy.
Right.
And certainly Saddam Hussein, if you look at his track record, if you look, if you analyze his pronouncements, but mostly his actions on the ground. A week before the war, I was at the office of then Republican Senate leader, Senator Bob Dole, and I indicated that Saddam Hussein was on a war path, and in fact, it was not Israel the primary target, but it was Kuwait, an ally of America.
Wow.
And therefore, for the sake of America's allies in the Gulf, for the sake of the free flow of oil to America, the U.S. is well advised to preempt against Saddam Hussein. The reaction was a roaring laughter concerning such a creative argument as they defined it. A week later, when the invasion took place, I was asked by some of the people who were at the room whether I had special connections with the Israeli intelligence. My response was that all I had to do was to read the writing on the wall.
Right.
And the same thing, unfortunately, characterizes American administration today. The writing on the wall is very clear. Iran is on a war path. Iran is on a path of becoming nuclear for military purposes, and this is evidenced by Iranian Iranian policy. This is evidenced by Iranian alliances with rogue regimes throughout the
China,
world.
China, Russia.
Well, this is North Korea, especially North Korea. This is evidenced by North Korean-Iranian joint efforts to develop more sophisticated missiles which could reach the U.S. from Iran. This is evidenced by Iranian subversive activities inside Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, etc. And this is evidenced by the identity of the leadership in Iran, namely the mullahs and the ayatollahs, and their very radical, extreme worldview. This is evidenced also by the identity of President Rouhani, who is defined as a moderate by the U.S. administration, but when you examine his track record, it is Rouhani who was the chief negotiator with the free world, promising the free world for about 15 years that Iran had no intentions to develop nuclear capabilities. And here we are today,
yeah,
at the last lap of the Iranian marathon towards nuclearization, and once again we hear the administration in Washington telling us Iran is a potential constructive power and constructive peaceful partner.
Let me ask you something, sir. What is your... There's a lot of talk out there, and I think this pertains to the same thing. Go ahead, if you don't mind setting the tray there, I want to ask you a question. I think it pertains to the same thing, but what would you say the threat of EMP is, electromagnetic pulse? Because there's a lot of... There are a lot of people that have been talking about Iran and other countries forming collaborating for a possible EMP strike. In fact, on Fox News several times, they've had military strategists on and said that EMP is a very real threat from Iran and other rogue countries. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I have an easy answer. This is not part of my my expertise,
okay,
and therefore I cannot really comment or assess the degree of the threat, which definitely exists.
Okay. Well, it's just something a lot of people ask questions about.
Absolutely.
And I know it's something that is a real threat that we don't often talk about. Now, tell us about the Edinger Report, because we want to be able to promote that, and we want folks to go and sign up for the Edinger Report. How can we find it? How can we sign up and get your emails for the Edinger Report, and when did you actually start it?
Well, the Edinger Report was initiated upon conclusion of my diplomatic service in Washington, which was also my retirement from the civil service. And at that time, I decided to persist in the cultivation of U.S.-Israel relations as a private person. And writing that weekly report has been a key tool in maintaining my network in Washington, which gradually expanded way beyond Washington.
Nice.
I have a website which is called The Ettinger Report. Ettinger with the two T's. And when you click www.theettingerreport.com, you get the inventory of my weekly products, which aim at generating out-of-the-box thinking about national security issues, which are critical to both the U.S. as well as Israel. I have been highlighting U.S.-Israel relations, particularly unique Israeli contributions,
right,
to America's national security, the power of Congress, U.S. policy in the Middle East, not being bashful about criticizing the current Obama, John Kerry policies in the area.
Well, sir, I want to say we're out of time, but we're gonna advertise. We're gonna have on the Facebook page when we post the time of your show, we're gonna have a link so folks can sign up for
Thank
the Edinger Report. We want to get you promoted, because what you have to say, obviously, we've gotten some great information here today, and it's very important that we lend an ear to your voice. And I want to say thank you, sir, for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you to everyone that listens to Insight to Israel, the truth about the Jewish state that a lot of folks are just afraid to tell, sir. And I want to say thank you again for being here. And we look forward to your monthly contribution to Insight to Israel. And thank you to America's Web Radio. Thank you, and God bless the Patriot Conservative in the United States of America that stand for truth and the Constitution and for Judeo-Christian principles. And thank you, and God bless the Jewish people as they fight for sovereignty and security.
Thank you very much.